Listen up, people. Do you think it's okay to drive stoned? Do you? Like, maybe you think, hey, I know what I'm doing. I can handle this. Or maybe it would be like, hey, I know what I'm doing. I can handle this. The truth is, your reaction times slow way down when you're high. Not only do you put yourself in danger, but everyone around you. Stop kidding yourself. Find a sober ride, take a cab, do whatever you got to do to stay safe. If you feel different, you drive different. Learn more at NHTSA.gov. That's NHTSA.gov. Drive high, get a DUI. Also, from Matt Groening, legendary creator of The Simpsons and Futurama, comes an epic new animated adventure, Disenchantment. Set in a medieval fantasy world called Dreamland, Disenchantment follows the misadventures of a hard-drinking young princess named Bean, her feisty elf companion Elfo, and her personal demon Lucy. And believe me, it's not all glass slippers and cute forest creatures. Watch Disenchantment, streaming now, only on Netflix. All right, let's do the show.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckadelics? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. I'm not at home. I'm in Chicago. I'm in Chicago. I got a show. Well, I had a show. I'm taping this a little early. I just got here, but I would have had a show last night if everything went as planned. I'm taping this a couple days before this episode airs, and this is a good episode. I've got Shooter Jennings on, son of Waylon Jennings, country music and alt-rock and just rock and experimental music guy, Shooter Jennings. Never met him. Nice talking to him. Rob Riggle is also stopping by for a second to talk about his new thing. But I'm excited to be in Chicago. I like Chicago. I've always liked Chicago. And I'm here to shoot the final season of Easy, Joe Swanberg's Netflix series. I'm reprising, is that the word, my character Jacob Malko, the graphic novelist. And this is it, I think. This is the last season. And it's going to be exciting. I'm going to be working with Jane Addams again and Melanie Lynskey, who I love. I've never worked with her. I haven't seen her in years, it feels like. I don't think I have, not since I talked to her on this show. So that's why I'm in Chicago. I'm also doing a show at the Thalia Hall. But that will have all already have happened yesterday. And let's just hear, maybe, hey, it went great. I'm going to try that. Why not say that ahead of time? Did I jinx it? No, I don't think so. I only think I'd jinx it if I get paid before the show. But I am in Chicago. Did I mention to you that there is a Dr. Katz audiobook now? It's on Audible. We used to do Dr. Katz. Some of you remember, some of you older people or some of you comedy nerds who have gone back and done the research. We used to do an animated series called Dr. Katz with Jonathan Katz playing a therapist. It was done in Squiggle Vision. Many comics appeared on the show back in the day. It was recorded in Newton, Massachusetts, as I recall. And it was basically Jonathan Katz and Laura Silverman, John Benjamin. But you kind of do your bits to this therapist who was played by Katz. Well, it's back, and it's available now on Audible. You can get the new version. It's an audio version. I did one, and it should be fun. Jonathan is still the perfect Dr. Katz. And here's a little bit of it. Here's a little bit of the one I did, if you want to get a taste. Here's a taste.
You feel like you're regressing around your mom.
The sad part is the same insecurities come back. My reactiveness comes back. She pushes my buttons. Right. She does it on purpose. I was surprised. I thought I'd gotten past all this stuff. But my mistake was letting her stay at my house.
Oh, no.
That was the plan, is that I got a new house, and I got an extra bedroom now, specifically so I could have people stay over, not really remembering that I don't like that.
Well, especially if those people are your parents.
Parents, relatives, friends. It's all strange. Yeah. You know, I guess I wanted to have the option. I wanted to be able to say, hey, you know, I've got an extra bedroom, you know, in my house, so it's really not a problem for you to stay. Oh, you're going to get a hotel anyways? Good for you, though. It's probably more comfortable. So that's the new Dr. Katz. You can order the new Dr. Katz audiobook at audible.com, or it's free when you start a 30-day trial. So enjoy that. Enjoy it. Rob Riggle. I've not talked to Rob Riggle in a while, and it was always good. I like seeing Rob. He's a good guy, solid guy, and he's solid in the real sense. You know, he's an ex-Marine. He's a solid dude, and he's got a new show. It's available on Sony Crackle. It's called Rob Riggle's Ski Master Academy. Premieres this Thursday, August 23rd. You can stream it for free on Sony Crackle. So, this is me talking to Rob back at the garage. It's a nice chat. Nice chat, me and Mr. Riggle.
Got a pool?
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, we didn't for a long time. For the first 8 years, we didn't.
You built it? You put it in?
We got a new house.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So you're using it now, right?
Yes. Yes.
How old are the kids?
10 and 14.
Oh, so they like it. They bring prime friends
time.
Over. Everybody.
It's prime time.
Everyone's hanging out at your house?
Which is how I like it, yeah. Believe it or not. I actually like it that
You know
way.
Where they are.
I kind of do. And it must be a control thing, but yeah. I do like having everybody assemble.
Right, yeah. Just have your friends come over here.
Exactly.
Yeah. You want to have a girl party? Bring your girls over.
And we tried to make the house accommodating so that it would be a good place to gather.
Were there boys or girls?
The oldest is a girl, and the youngest is a boy.
So you encourage that. You're the cool folks. It's fun to hang out.
We're cool enough. We're not the bring your coolers over and party at our house parents.
You smoke weed?
Yeah.
Smoke weed.
No. We're not those folks. But, we try to make it an entertaining house. Those days are, not that we'll ever entertain the underage partying, but those days are coming soon enough.
Where they're not underage anymore? And
She's 14, he's 10.
Yeah.
And, you know, the next 10 years, you're going to see some transitioning going on.
Yeah, you ready? Are you ready?
Nobody's ready.
I don't know.
I just try to remember what I did.
Yeah. Be helpful when you have a daughter.
Oh, it's the worst. It's the worst. Oh, that's the worst. Because I know they're just boys. You know, they're walking hormones, and it's not their fault. It's just the nature. It's the nature of the beast, and I know what they're like, and I know they're knuckleheads.
Is she the knuckleheads?
No, she's actually really smart and very creative. She's so far advanced beyond what I was at 14.
Yeah, you gotta keep a sort of a kind eye that a knucklehead doesn't ruin her for life.
Yeah. And it can happen.
I know, man.
Yeah.
It's scary for me. I don't even have kids. All it takes is one shitty boyfriend to fuck everything you put into it up.
Yeah. The good thing is she's resilient. So even if some turd comes along, she's going to weather that storm and be fine.
And you have a good enough relationship where she would talk to you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And God bless that. And my wife. She'll talk. Because, you know, obviously it may be weird to talk to dad about some things.
Sure, yeah.
She's good enough with mom that she can lock
in. There's no pushback. She doesn't hate you guys.
Not yet.
She's not going to show you.
Yeah, no. Thank God. There's none of that. It's been pretty healthy and wholesome.
Oh, good.
But yeah, no, I've seen the families that have that. And that's a whole nother bag.
So, what have you been doing, man? I mean, I know you got this Ski Master Academy.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, what have you been doing since, like, when was the last time I saw you? Like, 5 years ago?
I think it was probably 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago.
You've been doing movies and stuff?
I've been always working. That's the thing.
You are.
Because the only thing is, and you know this as well as I do, you eat what you kill.
Yeah.
So if you're not hustling all the time, you're going to be hurting.
Or if you're not making yourself available in an aggressive way.
Yeah, and I got like five irons in the fire at all times.
Right. Calling your agent going, I'm here.
Yeah.
What's up?
Yeah.
Where are we at?
Yeah, you remember that thing we talked about? And then it's a constant struggle to get your reps on the phone.
Oh, I know. Yeah, yeah.
And then you get a return call at the worst possible fucking time.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at midnight.
And you stop everything because you're a desperate, you know, fuck.
That's
you know,
it.
Like, you can only, everything falls apart for your image of who you are to the public, to yourself, when you're waiting to talk to a rep and then the phone. Oh God! I gotta take this.
And
it's a funeral, you know.
And you jump out of whatever you're doing, and then when you answer it, you try to be nonchalant and cool, like hey, Tom, what's going on, man? Like I've been, it's kind of an annoyance you called, but what's up?
Yeah, what's up? Hold on a second. I'll be right there.
Yeah,
it's the agent.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, man.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And then they're like, "What do you want, Riggle?" And I was like, "Hey, do you remember that thing we talked about? I was just thinking maybe if it was possible we could have lunch and then I could maybe explain myself and why this is such a great idea." And like, okay, Riggle, we'll see what we can do. Don't panic too much. Just relax. Try to relax, kid. Fuck you.
Then you hang up. You go back to what you're doing. You know nothing. Yeah, there's nothing yet.
Piece of shit. So I've been working, trying to. I've spent like 4.5 months down in Atlanta last year just doing films.
That's where everything is now.
I'm telling you, that's, yeah, that or Vancouver.
Was
that's
it
where the tax
was it the summer?
It was, part of it was in the summer, ooh, part of it was in the spring.
Oh, summer in Atlanta. Rough.
Yeah.
It's humid here now. When did that fucking happen? It feels like New Jersey.
I don't dig it either, because one of the advantages of California is no humidity.
What's going on?
Yeah, it's horse shit, and I don't know where it's coming from. Yeah, it's coming in from fucking Jersey. I don't know.
From Jersey.
It's somewhere. It's
in real trouble.
Somebody's pumping in this humidity that ain't part of our program out here.
No, no. The program seems to be changing rapidly.
75, sunny, crystal clear, and crisp.
Yeah.
You know, and then at night it drops down to a beautiful 55.
That's nice.
So you got a nice sweatshirt or whatever, and you're golden. And it's the most beautiful weather in the world.
Yeah, here.
Here, and
last
now
year.
It's
Two
all
years
of a sudden
ago.
It's fucking Orlando.
Yeah, I don't know
where
what's
going on. It's a wet sauna.
I don't know what happened.
I don't dig it.
I don't dig it at all. Yeah. So it was really one of the only good things about living out here.
Yeah. Yeah, because I was like, this state's so fucking expensive, and the taxes.
No humidity.
And I'm like, it's a weather tax. It's worth it because of the weather tax.
Yeah, no.
No.
I don't know, dude. So, Vancouver, too. You were up there doing work?
Yeah. Did a couple films up there as well. And 12 Strong, which was a war movie with like Chris Hemsworth and Michael Shannon.
Oh, yeah? And you were one of the guys with the helmets?
I was one of the...
Which war?
Afghanistan.
Oh, so...
And actually, funny story, I actually played in the movie Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers, who was in charge of the 3rd Battalion 5th Special Forces Group in Mazar-e Sharif in northern Afghanistan in October of 2001. As a young captain myself in the Marines, I reported to Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers in November of 2001 in Mazar-e Sharif and worked on his staff, and then I play him in the movie.
Wow.
So I'm playing my old boss in the movie.
So you kind of had a line in.
Oh, well, I knew the whole thing. I knew everything about their program, the mission that they did, even because I had a security clearance, so I knew what their mission was. This was just declassified a couple of years back.
Wow.
So,
that must have been cool.
Yeah, so it was fun to see the story finally get to, you know.
How'd they do with it?
They did a good job.
Oh, good.
I think they did a good job.
Yeah.
And then,
Now, when you're on a set like that, do you stop the action and go like, yeah, I don't think it's, you guys are quite doing this.
I was there. Sometimes, and it just comes down to like the nomenclature of the language.
Right.
You know, if they say, whatever, I can't even think of an example right now, but if they get that wrong, I say, actually, I think it would be said this way.
In Marine speak
or, military speak, because it's all acronyms anyway. But,
right.
And they were open to it, but for the most part, they had their shit squared away.
Oh, that's
they
cool, man. That's cool.
And then I did a drama, which a heavy drama, where I play a father of
Was the war movie a comedy?
Well, it was I call that a straight role more than a drama role.
Okay, all right.
But the drama was like, you know, I mean, we're talking about some real emoting here, some real, some deep subjects. Like my daughter in the movie was dying of rare disease. And so I never get those opportunities. And that was a really cool.
How'd you do with it?
I think I did okay.
Just cry?
I got tore up. But people liked it.
Good.
It went well.
That's great.
Yeah. And then, and now I have a movie coming out, Kevin Hart and Tiffany Haddish, called, Night School.
Oh, yeah.
Coming out in September.
Oh, good.
And then this thing, Robert Will's Ski Master Academy, is an idea I've had forever. And I finally got off my lazy ass and put the pitch together.
Yeah.
And got somebody to buy off on it, Sony Crackle.
Uh-huh.
God bless them.
Uh-huh.
You know,
so this was like originally years ago, like a Comedy Central or Funny or Die pitch or what?
You know what it was? It actually started, people, you know, this fucking town. Hey, what are you working on? What are you working on, Riggle? What are you working on these days? Right. What are you working on?
Yeah.
And I would say, I finally got to the point where I was tired of explaining myself. So I would just say, I'm thinking about opening a jet ski academy. You know, and that would be my answer.
Yeah.
And I would.
A what academy?
A jet ski academy.
Oh, jet ski. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And I would say, I've been given a lot of thought to open a jet ski academy, and I would say it with a straight face and a very sincere delivery. And most of the comedians I knew, you know, knew I was doing a bit and fucking around.
Sure.
But a lot of folks didn't fucking know. They didn't know.
Yeah.
And so they'd be like, oh, that's amazing. That's, when did you get, you know, and I wouldn't give it up. I would just say, oh, well.
With that fucking horrible, sad voice. Like, oh, good for you. So you're out, huh?
You quit.
Yeah, good for you.
Yeah. And then you could see in their mind, they were like, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Another one bites the dust.
But it's just that dumb sort of like, you know, all of a sudden you're a victim of some kind. Oh, well, that's great.
Oh,
yeah. Jet skis. No, it's fun.
Yeah.
Fun.
Any life decision you make that doesn't fit their model.
Yeah, yeah. Ooh, okay. Yeah. Good for you. You're okay, though, right?
Yeah. Oh, God, I know that. I know that fucking judgment.
It's the worst, man.
So anyway, that's how it started. And it started that way. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, well, that would be a funny world, actually. A jet ski academy. if I owned a jet ski academy, I'd be like this B-list celebrity who fucking, just like Oprah has her school in Africa, and now LeBron has his school in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Why not me have my academy?
Right, right.
And so I created...
For those less fortunate white people. Is that what
you... Well, I mean, look, teaching personal watercraft safety to troubled urban youth.
All right.
I see the sense in that.
Oh, troubled urban youth. That's what you're using?
Sure, why not?
Yeah.
So anyway, I put together a pitch with a couple comedy buddies, and Sony Crackle bought into it.
What is it, like Caddyshack?
It's
do you know what I mean? Is it like there's just some, you know, you got a few guys working at the place.
Yeah.
One of them's a stoner. One of them's like a troublemaker.
It's set up like an academy. So you have students.
Uh-huh.
And you have, instructors.
Uh-huh.
And then you have me, who is, like the figurehead who runs it, but I'm kind of there, kind of not. I'm very self-serving.
As an academy, though, it's a jet skiing academy.
Yes.
All right. So yeah. Okay.
So it's obnoxious to begin with. It's
right.
Absurd.
It's like fun school.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
And you know, there's all kinds of mischief that the cadets get into.
Do they live at the school?
Uh huh.
Oh, so it's like camp.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Like 2 week program.
Or a boarding school, maybe.
Oh, really?
A boarding school.
Do you have regular school, too?
No, God, no.
Oh, so
there's no time for that.
So it's just, but how long are they?
Personal watercraft.
I'm sorry if I'm asking too many detailed questions.
Well,
I want to know if this is realistic or not, Rob.
It's super realistic. I mean, it's a whole nother level.
Yeah.
We didn't miss a single thing.
Yeah.
We didn't miss a single thing.
So, but no, seriously. So how long do they stay there? You know, it doesn't matter.
We'll say a school year.
Sure, okay.
A school year.
So they don't go to regular school and they just learn how to do jet skiing.
That's right.
For the year.
That's right. Because we actually, at the end of 8 episodes, they did graduate from the academy.
Oh, good.
So maybe 8 episodes, that's how long they go to school.
Yeah, well, that's good. That's about right. Yeah. That sounds about right.
That's about right.
Who are the other goofballs on this thing?
Paul Scheer.
Oh, good, yeah.
Is one of my old-time buddies from UCB.
Sure.
Eliza Coop.
Uh-huh.
Very funny lady.
Yeah.
Billy Merritt.
So I did UCB guys.
And then, you know, I reached out to Cheech Marin.
Yeah.
He came out and played with us.
Did he?
Yeah. Dermot Mulroney, Jamie Lynn Sigler, David Arquette.
Wow.
All came in as guest stars.
Sure.
Chris McDonald,
uh-huh.
You may know as Shooter McGavin, and Happy Gilmore.
Okay.
If you saw that.
Sure.
If you didn't see that, you probably saw Grease 2. He was one of the T-Birds in Grease 2.
I might have missed both of those. I might have.
I don't know how.
Yeah, I know.
But okay.
It's crazy. I don't know how I miss most things either, but I do. I do miss most
things. Do you find yourself, in this town especially, I'm constantly being told, all right, I know there's a lot out there, but you've got to watch this.
Yeah,
and you've got to watch this.
Yeah.
And now my list of what I've got to watch is fucking ridiculous.
Yeah, who the fuck are these people telling you that? Or there is also people where that, you know, when it's like, hey, everybody knows this thing. How do you not know it? I'm like, I guess I'm not in the right loop. I don't pay that much attention to Twitter anymore, but like all of a sudden everybody knows a thing and I'm like, how did I miss it?
Yeah.
How did I miss it? I get news on my phone.
Yes.
How did
And also, I'm starting to feel my age because I did an improv show the other night and we dropped.
You were winded?
We dropped, well, that. That. But I dropped a reference of Michael Dukakis.
Oh, boy.
And I literally saw everybody look at each other like, I don't know who Michael Dukakis is.
Wow.
And I realized, oh, shit.
Uh-huh.
Most of this audience was born 89, 90.
Wow. How old are you now?
I'm 48.
Yeah. I'm 54. I'm going to be 55 next month.
They didn't know who Dukakis was.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. I'm doing I have a Palm Pilot reference in one of my jokes. And the part, half of the joke is me explaining what it is.
That's good stuff, though. That's really good. That's awesome. Did I hear you say you were working on a new set? I shouldn't give anything away. I don't want to give anything away.
Oh, no. I'm just like, I'm doing some dates, you know, trying to put together an hour.
Oh, that's awesome.
I've got a lot of it. You know, it seems like that's something we need to do every year. Someone made this secret rule where you got to turn over an hour every year. But
I think that's Louis C.K., isn't it?
Kinda, but like there were guys who did it before. He just made a spectacle of it.
He was churning them out.
Yeah, but a lot of those guys, like Carlin, would do one every year. I mean, it's not that unusual when it's your bread and butter to a comic. If you were one of the HBO guys, you know, who got specials, a year and a half, a year. Yeah, I mean, I do it anyways. It turns out, really, but now you think you're more conscious of it, you know.
And then there's that, like, once you dump the hour, there's that moment where you're like, I got nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Where does it come from?
That's a lonely place.
It is, but, like, it just, it comes out of nowhere. It comes out of thin air for me. It's like, I don't know, things are starting to come together somehow.
Uh-huh.
You know, if I keep getting on stage.
That's very true. And it's a scary process, but once you do it a couple times, you just trust in the process somehow.
Yeah, you just, like, well, I riff out stuff. Like, you're an improviser. Yeah. I do that with stand-up. So I'll go to a low-key place, you know, with my, you know, outline of ideas.
Right.
And just riff them out and see what sticks and then try to remember. Like, I always think, like, I'll listen to it and I'll make notes. I never do. Yeah. It's like, it's going to stick here, like, you know, that thing. I lose, like,
especially when you get off stage, it flies out of your head.
Yeah, but, like, also, like, you know, what are you really going to work on?
Uh-huh.
But then, like, you should go listen to the tapes because they're like, oh, there was that one beat. What was it? And I'm like, I don't even.
I didn't embrace taping myself for a long time.
Right.
And then I did once. I finally remembered to do it. Maybe it was just I forgot. And I remembered one show. I think it was at the University of Missouri, but I took my phone.
Yeah.
And I put it on the bench
right
of the stool and recorded the show.
Yeah.
So fucking glad I did that because I went back and I listened.
Yeah.
And I finally kind of heard my own show and I heard the responses.
Yeah.
And it really helped dial in some things.
Tighten it up?
Yeah.
What do you
do? And I lost a lot of superfluous shit because there's always.
Yeah. You want to fill time.
Yeah. Of course. Of course.
Let me over explain this for 10 minutes.
Oh my God. And when you say when you are discovering stuff, I remember, John Oliver was the guy who kind of got me to do stand up. And he would start, I would just go tell a story.
Yeah.
A 3 minute story, a 5 minute story. And I knew where there would be some punches.
Yeah.
But the rest was kind of, let's see what we can do in the storytelling process.
Yeah.
As far as.
Sure, yeah.
And that's where I would wing it and I would get laughs where there weren't any. And I'd say, okay, I got to remember that, got to remember
right,
that. Right,
exactly, exactly.
And then you just tell the story 100 times and eventually you got 3 tight, funny minutes.
Sure. Embellish it. You can get more minutes.
Exactly.
Yeah, go off on thoughts within the story.
Exactly.
So do you still do stand up a lot?
No.
Oh.
No, I have not done it. And the reason is because my set was done. It had a 2-year, 3-year run.
Yeah.
Who am I? 3-year run.
So do you see that as a show? Cause I mean, you don't really come from stand up. So when you put together a show, you know, are you in character? You go as you?
No,
you...
When I'm doing stand up, I do, it's me.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing improv, it's improv. You know, you play what you got to play.
Right, right, right.
I wasn't playing theaters. I was playing clubs and, I was on the road a lot. I had 2 young kids.
Yeah.
The return on investment was questionable.
Yeah.
And the
time investment, you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was gone so much and the money was okay, but
missing
it wasn't.
Missing the kids growing up kind of thing.
There was a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
So.
Wife doesn't like you anymore.
A lot of that. And I still liked her a lot.
Yeah. Of course. You're out there in Siberia.
Fuck yeah.
And she's just like, why isn't he helping me?
Right, right. And somehow I'm bringing home the money, but I'm still the bad guy.
Yeah, of course.
That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, yeah. Your children don't know your name. You want to do your act for them?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they'll enjoy that.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. So I stopped doing it, but I'm going to quit it.
Right.
I just need to get to a stage where I can get back into it.
Sure.
And now that I live out here, I got to be honest, fucking New York is the place to build a set.
Yeah.
Because you can hit 5 mics easy.
Yeah, you can do that here. It's just a chore.
It's a chore. For me, it's a fucking chore. Live it out 1,000 miles.
Right.
And then it's a half hour between gigs, and maybe you get 2 or 3 mics a night, too.
What, to do stand-up?
To get up and get, you know, work out like 10, 15 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, and you also got to be in. You know, it's better to do it at a club. Like, when I'm trying to really build an hour, I used to go to the Steve Allen Theater and just, like, do a month of Tuesdays.
Yeah.
And just, you know, $5 ticket and just riff, you know, for an hour or two to see what happens. Now I've been going to the Ice House, but the Ice House... Is actually a real club.
The Pasadena?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, I want to riff and do shit, but you're like, this is a real comedy club. So that muscle goes in, like, I gotta give them a good show.
That's
know?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a hot room.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Good. Good, good,
good.
Should
go there.
Yeah, no, I have buddies that go there. Sarah Tiana and Roy Albanese. Yeah. These guys, they hit that place a lot.
Yeah, it's a good workout room.
Yeah.
It's almost like cheating. It's such a good room.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah. So how do people watch this? Is it easy to watch?
It's so easy. It's on Sony Crackle, which is free.
Okay.
Which is great. Because, you know, some of these pay in these digital sites, the Netflix, Hulu, I love them, but you got to pay.
Yeah.
This Sony Crackle is free.
And so how do you get there?
You go to, you can Google it. You can get the app on your phone.
Sony Crackle.
Sony Crackle.
That was a right. Okay.
Yeah, and then it comes out August 23rd. All the episodes will be out, and it's a really funny show with an amazing cast. It's ridiculous comedy. There's no message or agenda. It's just straight up fucking balls out comedy.
Good. So you did 8.
Yeah, I did 8.
And now what are you doing?
Well, I just shot a pilot for Fox.
Oh, good.
Literally last night.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How'd it go?
Taped it last night. It went great.
Who's in it? Is it all you?
No, it's a three-hander. It's Caitlin Olson from Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And the Mick and also Leah Remini.
Yeah.
And myself.
Oh, it's funny ladies.
Yeah. It's a great...
You're a funny lady.
It's a great... thank you very much. I get that a lot, especially with this beard.
Yeah. Did you get some laughs? Three camera thing?
Yeah, it was multicam.
No shit.
Yeah, and we got some laughs, and it was great having the audience. So a live audience always makes things better.
Sure.
And it was cool. So we literally taped it last night, and who knows? We have to test it and edit it.
For FX or for Fox?
For Fox.
Exciting, man.
Thanks, bud.
I'm glad you're working. You seem well.
Yeah, I'm very impressed with your... Can I mention your house?
Sure.
Your house is gorgeous.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Yeah, I really love it.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to keep it... I'm going to try not to tell people where it is.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. But it's a gorgeous house, man.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. I got lucky. Thanks,
you
man.
You did well.
Thank you. Rob Riggle. Isn't that fun? Did I just say that? Wasn't that fun? I never say that. I never say, we're going to have fun. That sounds like fun. Ooh, fun. Wasn't that fun? Man, something's changing. Something is happening in ironic counterbalance to the world with my well-being and sense of self. I'm going to let it happen. I'm going to keep letting it happen. So I almost had Shooter Jennings on a while back. We got common friends in Jeff Tate, but it never happened. Now, I'll try to catch up, man. This new record, Shooter's new record, I got to be honest with you, it's a straight up country record. It's called Shooter. It's available now wherever you get music. And his dad is Waylon Jennings, and many of you know that I grew up in New Mexico, but, you know, I was surrounded by country music to a certain degree. I didn't engage in it much, but I am old enough to remember what was unleashed on the country after the Urban Cowboy movie with John Travolta and Deborah Winger and John Glenn, I believe, who mostly what I remember of that movie is John Glenn taking the last shot of some mezcal tequila and playing with the caterpillar in between his teeth and a mechanical bull and line dancing. Well, after that happened, I don't even know the year on that, but I must have been in junior high or high school. But all of a sudden, there were large Western dance halls opening up, at least where I lived in New Mexico. And there was a very large contingent of people tucking their shirts in, wearing cowboy hats and cowboy boots, and jigging in a line at these large dance halls. That was what clubbing looked like in the Southwest at a certain period in history. But the cowboy culture exists where I grew up, and the state fair was always, they always had Waylon and Willie and Johnny and Roy and Buck and whoever, Merle and George and Dolly, Loretta. They were always there every year at the rodeo at the state fair. And I grew up sort of not with much cowboy in me per se, and not with it in the house, but I did have boots. I had boots, and at some point I had a hat. I had a straw Stetson hat. Wore some black cowboy boots when I was a grown man during that time where you wore black cowboy boots. Folks, is there anything harder to move than a sofa? My producer, Brendan, read this copy and then told me that one time when he moved, his sofa had such an irregular shape it got stuck in the building's hallway and they had to saw it in half to get it out. Bye-bye, sofa.
Well, Burrow is changing the game with a fully customizable sofa that's easy to move and built to last. Its modular design means you can grow your love seat into a chaise sectional by adding sections, and it also makes it super easy to move into and out of any space. Everything is personalized to you. The arm height, sofa color, leg material, and size. I know all about it because I went on the Burrow site and ordered one. I went with navy blue, high armrests, and mahogany legs, and it was easy as clicking on some pictures, and it's really a nice piece of furniture. I put it in my office, my new office, in my new house. Burrow is the sofa that grows with you. It fits your life and your living room. Get $75 off your Burrow sofa at burrow.com/WTF. That's burrow.com/WTF. Burrow, furniture that's fit for modern life at home. Dig it? Cool. All right, so Shooter. Yeah, man. It was good talking to Shooter. It's good talking to him about his dad. It was good talking to him about his music. It was good talking to him about his new record. Yeah. I mean, I like the record. The record's fucking straight up country, and he's got a very eclectic catalog, this Shooter Jennings character. And as I told you, I got a little nostalgic. Albuquerque, New Mexico, cowboy hats, caravan dance club, where my dad used to go during his secret life and dance and Western style. And just the basic, you know, pickups. That element that was there was sort of infused into the culture. I had a Western belt. Still do. That Western belt buckle. Still do. Don't wear it much. Got some new cowboy boots. Haven't worn them. I got them because I wore them in a movie. But maybe I'll wear them. It's in there. That's all I'm saying. So I brought that a little bit. I think I did. Anyway, so this is me talking to Shooter Jennings. His new record, Shooter, is available now wherever you get your music. Nice chat with him.
Yeah, I remember that Tate and I tried to hook me and you up, Jeff Tate.
Yeah, I love Jeff. Man.
And how, you go back with him or like?
I met him through, I met Doug Benson first. And
yeah.
I went on Doug's
thing,
Getting Doug with High thing. And
yeah.
And then he had, Doug started following me around touring and doing those Doug Love Movies things. And he invited me to one of those. That's where I met Jeff.
He started following you on purpose?
Yeah. They booked a couple of those along my route. And kind of, so there was like a couple times that they were in the same cities as me. And it was like,
well, that's nice to have a little comedian following.
Yeah, it was fun, man.
I was out with Dean Del Rey last night.
Oh, I did his thing one time.
I know, yeah. Told me, yeah, I talked to him for like 9 hours. Dean talks to everybody for 9 hours. And then he trims it down. Yeah, but he was talking about Stargun.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
My old man.
Well, Dean was going on about Stargun because, yeah, he was out here during that time. What was that, the late 80s or something?
No, God. Kidding me?
Mid-90s?
It was 2000.
Oh, you're younger than us. I forgot.
I was born 79.
So. Yeah, I'm born 63. I think Dino is too.
Yeah.
So it was the mid-90s, but like, I listened to some of it this morning.
Oh, boy.
And what do you mean? It's great shit. Like, what do you,
I don't know. It's cringeworthy to me sometimes because I was 21 years old writing all this shit and like couldn't,
yeah,
you know, didn't know what to write or to do.
Right. But it's sort of interesting that, you know, it was just solid, you know, hard rock music.
Right on.
And it was like, you know, it was LA hard rock music with that, you know, the lyrics were sort of like, I'm in LA basically. Right.
Yeah, dude. Exactly.
I can see how that might be embarrassing.
It's lyrically, it's so embarrassing for me. I mean, there's some things, you know, but I'm like screaming and yes and all. But I mean, I literally could not have been more redneck off the turnip truck type of situation in moving to LA. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not like a redneck, like a hunter or anything like that, but I lived in Nashville and I'm like, ooh, LA, like, I want to go there. That's where all the rock stars and all my favorite dudes went, you know, and I visited as a kid. And
But you must have some sense. I mean, I can't imagine, like, first of all, like the idea, you know, because I've talked to a few cats who, you know, your dad is Waylon Jennings.
Right.
So like, it takes some sort of insanity or balls to be like, well, I'm Waylon Jennings, kid. I'm going to sing too.
Right.
Like, you know, because that could go either way.
Oh, yeah, it could go. A lot of potential for failure. I mean, dude, like for me, I was so like, an MTV kid and a rock kid and shit living in Nashville. Me and my dad were very close. He was a great dad. It wasn't one of those situations where, like, the famous dad, never see him or something. We were very close.
And he wasn't some weird, abusive, drugged out freak in the house.
Not at all, man. He was like, he was a great, you know, and I he had me late too, so I probably missed some of the craziness that, like, my older brothers and sisters did, you know.
What's the age difference?
My youngest is 15 years older than me.
Really?
Yeah, my youngest one. That's my mom's daughter from her previous marriage to Dwayne Eddy. So it's like my mom had one and my dad had five.
Well, your mom, Jessie Coulter, right?
That's right.
She's a significant country star.
They were on the Outlaws thing together.
She was married to Dwayne Eddy?
Dwayne Eddy before, yeah.
So you got a half brother who's Dwayne Eddy's kid?
Half sister.
Half sister is Dwayne Eddy's kid?
Yeah.
Rebel Rouser?
That's right. That's right.
Bow, bow.
Yeah, I used to go over to his house as a kid.
Now, I love that thing.
Yeah. I love Dwayne Eddy. He's fucking awesome. But, like, you know, but I was there. I mean, man, you got to understand, I'm like, I'm still just a big kid. And, like, when I was little, one of the most profound influences on me was the Muppet movie.
Yeah.
Because, like, here's all this Hollywood business. You know?
Yeah.
And then there was, like, my dad did that movie, Follow That Bird, and it was like Big Bird. So, like, as a kid, I was getting ingrained in this Hollywood thing. And then I discovered, like, Guns N' Roses, and then that led to, you know, the back history of Hollywood and the Doors and all this stuff. And then I was into Nine Inch Nails and fucking Marilyn Manson and all this shit. And I was like, that's where I'm going. Like, there was either New York or LA. Like, Nashville, in my opinion, it blew. The music sucked. Like, there were a couple maybe okay rock bands that were burgeoning around there, like Jason and the Scorchers and shit. But, like,
oh, yeah.
But otherwise, it was really shitty. And I hated the Waylon's Kid thing. I did not want to play country at the time. I was like, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And I moved here. And, man, I didn't have any foresight to that, but I got here and spent, you know, a good 10 years where there was no Waylon talk at all. Like, I could not get into the clubs or whatever, the party places, just like everybody else could not get into them.
No one cared about Waylon.
Right. There was only like one or two people.
They start play on you in a little while. It's like, wait a minute, you guys should know my dad.
No, I loved it. Like, to me, I just,
you're free.
Like, and I was a kid, and I was 21 years old, like, spending my drinking years away from my parents and being nuts.
Yeah, because I have to assume that, you know, your entire life in Nashville, you know, you got everybody saying, there's Waylon's kid.
Right, right.
You grew up with that. But in terms of, like, how you grew up, so your dad was married before your mom.
Right.
And had, like, another couple kids. She's got a kid.
He had five from several other marriages. And, like, he had his first... Yeah, I mean, my mom was his fourth marriage. And my mom had one previous marriage. So, by the time that we... But, you know, it was weird because I'm growing up and all of those kids were around. Like, they had gotten, you know... Of course, I missed out probably their teenage years where things were more confusing.
Of course, but...
But, like, they were all together. They had kids. Like, my nephew is... I have two nephews that are a year younger than me.
Uh-huh.
One of them's a rapper named Struggle, and the other one's a singer named Way. I grew up with them, like, same age brothers, but they're, like, my brother's kids.
Oh, I get it. Oh, right, I get it.
Sister's kids, yeah.
So there are other music. Did any of the siblings go into music?
My sister plays piano and sings,
yeah.
And she does her thing. She kind of does more spiritual stuff and kind of along the lines
Christian-y.
Of what my mom's into, yeah.
Your mom's become
around the time that I was born, she became pretty, but her parents, like, her mom was a preacher.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They grew up in, like, a kind of revivalist kind of church in Mesa where they were, like, they had, like, a tent and they would, you know, and she would play in the band and her whole family grew up.
That's where she learned.
That's where she learned. Yeah,
the tent racket.
Right. And then she kind of came back around to it later in life, you know, but it's like, so my sister's kind of into that. And my brothers have dabbled in the business a little bit, but, like, my nephews, like, those two are singers. Almost everyone that has been a spawn of those, of my brothers and sisters have all gone into music.
Uh-huh.
Like, I think they've kind of seen the whole thing and wanted to jump in, but it's funny. It's cool. I mean, it's like our family's been so, in music has been around it that it's almost like, even if they weren't in music, they knew a lot about music.
Well, you know, Waylon, like I grew up in New Mexico and I remember, and my dad's wife literally is, you know, she's such a Willie Nelson head that it's like, it's freakish. Like, she had a quilt made of just concert t-shirts of basically Willie Nelson and
I love it. That sounds like my wife's mom. My wife's mom, Kathy, is like, she has like a like Misty in our house. We have like a velvet Willie that used to hang over one of the beds in their house they grew up in, you know.
So what I'm trying to picture though is like, because Nashville is certainly a different town when you were a young guy, right? A young kid.
Totally.
Like, it kind of turned in the last decade, really.
Last 5 years, to
really.
Be honest. Yeah, it feels like it's, I mean, it's 100 people moving there a day. I mean,
really?
It's got, 100? Yeah, crazy. I think that number's starting to drop off, but over the last 2 years, it was like 100 people a day. And it's kind of crazy to watch sheep move, though, because it's like, I remember moving here where it was like, you don't go to Silver Lake.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, like, people started coming in. And then, like, I remember when Austin was starting to burgeon, like, be pretty cool. About, like, 10 years ago, people started moving there. And then all of a sudden, like, Nashville happens, and like Brooklyn and Silver Lake kind of start emptying out, and they all start moving to Nashville.
Yeah, because there's this whole artisanal roots music sort of, you know, back to the earth, grow a beard shit going on. We got to get to that.
The lumberjack.
Yeah, the deep American jams. Music. Well, there's some cats like, you know, and then the, like the sort of, the you know, there was this, I talk about this more specifically in a minute, but there, it seemed like there was a, you know, this original wave. You know, whatever happens in mainstream country, you know, post your dad, you know, has always had some pushback from other country artists who are trying to, you know, make it more organic again. As it got a sort of further away from the roots of country, there was that first, you know, there was obviously Graham Parsons and that crew, right? And Emily Lou Harris. But then, you know, Steve Earle and those guys.
Yep.
And then it seems like you and Sturgill and, Margo Price.
Yeah, I just met her the other day for the first time.
I think she's great.
She's great.
So you're growing up in this. So, because I know you did this, this little sort of memorial album for George Jones, who I love. I love George Jones.
Yeah.
And just the idea that you're a little kid and you're in Nashville and, like, you know, who are the people that are coming over the house? Who are, like,
George came over a lot. I mean, I'll tell you, my dad's closest friends, what I would kind of say were, Carl Smith, who's a great old country singer, one of my dad's kind of icons when he was a kid, one of his heroes, and they became friends. He would come over a lot. Tony Joe White, I don't know if you ever got into him. He's unbelievable. He wrote Rainy Night in Georgia.
Oh,
and all that. Like, he's a Polk Salad Annie. Anyway.
Oh, wow.
Tony Joe White was one of the greatest. He used to come around a lot. George would come around a lot, you know. Before and after he got sober, you know, I don't remember, to be honest with you, any real stories of him not being sober, but my mom always tells stories about when I was little and he was trying to get off the booze and shit.
Yeah.
But they would come around, you know, Willie and stuff would occasionally come over, but he lived in Texas. So
yeah.
So those cats were kind of living.
Christofferson.
He'd kind of be around. Christofferson's the one that I'm the closest with since post my dad dying.
Oh, yeah.
I see him. Even now, I see him quite a bit. Is he in Nashville? No, he lives in L.A., between L.A. and Hawaii.
He
kind of lives in Hawaii. But
how's he doing? How's his head?
He's good, man. I mean, he's gone through some crazy shit that they thought was like
Alzheimer's
at first, and then it was Lyme disease. Like, they figured out he had some, you know, so he's been going through a lot of stuff. But, he's like awesome. He's still there. Everything's there. It's just like he has moments where he like trips over facts and history and stuff.
Who doesn't?
Right. But like my kids have gotten to be around him and stuff, which has meant a lot to me and them. And so it's like, he's a good, I mean, he called me the first couple Father's Days after my dad died, which I never would have expected to get.
Oh man, that's sweet.
Very sweet stuff. So.
So when you're coming up though, when do you decide, like, what's that moment? Cause I've talked to, who have I talked to? I've talked to Jacob Dylan. I've talked to, you know, Duncan Jones, who's David Bowie's kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously it's a different arena.
Duncan, man, I love Moon.
Anyway. Yeah, it's great. It's great. I liked his new one too.
I haven't seen it yet.
And you know, there's sort of the weight of it, but there is, I think with country, there's more, I think there's more of a tradition of family.
Totally. Because Julian Lennon had it a lot harder than I think anybody in country ever had, you know.
Right.
It's like,
and then, like, you got the whole Carter Cash, you know, empire, or there must have been a dozen of them.
And the Williams, there must have been a dozen of them.
I mean, to different degrees of fame, but and then Hank 1, 2, and 3. Hank 3's a little, you know, punk rock, right?
Yeah.
He, like, pushes the envelope, that guy.
Yeah, and metal and everything. I mean, dude, he did something so profound by putting out, like, Straight to Hell. Like, it created an entire entire genre. Like, there is still to this day
metal country
bluegrass guys that are doing, like, you know, where it's kind of like stringed instruments, but like these metal kind of lyrics and arrangements, yeah. and screams. So he kind of like.
So his old man is Hank too?
Hank Jr. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy's something.
Yeah, he is. Boy, he's a good artist, though. He's like, if you, it's like somewhere along the way, towards the end, I don't know what Kool-Aid got drank, but there was these 12 records in a row where he was the fucking best.
Right, really, yeah. So you look to that stuff a lot, you know.
To his earlier stuff. Yeah,
songwriting-wise
and singing-wise.
He can play, too, right?
Oh, man. He's piano, guitar, and everything.
And how's Hank III, like, you know, like, also the great thing about generational artists is that you can see the sickness.
Right. pattern.
Yes. How's everybody holding up over in Hank Williams' land?
Oh, man.
Or you. How do you hold up? I mean, I don't know what... I mean, there's this sort of archetype
right.
of, like, the outlaw country dude. And I think, like, to a certain degree, when I was younger, you know, I had my heroes. They were never sober. They were always fucking disasters.
Right. Right.
And, you know, the party, you don't know whether it's genetic or you're just sort of like, well, this is what I want to do. You know, I want to be like that. And then at some point, if you live long enough, you're like, I'm tired, man.
Yeah. You know? That's so true, man. I mean, dude, you know, for me, it's weird. It's like my dad never drank,
uh-huh.
but I drank all the time.
Yeah.
So there's like, we had certain.
He didn't do nothing?
No, he did. He did like pills back in the 60s and 70s. And then when cocaine came out, that was his preferred
pharmaceutical guy. Powders and pills.
Uppers was his thing.
You got to come down.
I'm more of a weed and booze guy.
Uh-huh.
I mean, but you know, like, I guess there is somewhat of an archetype, but I think that. It's an archetype that, like, it goes across all artistic things. I mean, you know, like, my favorite writers are, like, Hunter S. Thompson and Charles Bukowski, and people
sure.
that are, like, we're fucking...
Yeah, of course.
Excess monsters, you know, and it's like, to me, I just, like, I think there's just something there. And look, man, there's a lot of great sober artists out there. I mean, but the ones that definitely like ask the hard questions a lot of time tend to be the ones who are.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I think so. I think that, you know, people who push themselves, will get somewhere or not.
Right. Like, right.
You know, for all the ones you're saying that did get somewhere, there's, you know, just literally, you know, dozens, hundreds.
Who did not. Right. That's
just,
right.
You know, their pen just like went off the page and that was that. But
you are right.
But you know, so when did you decide? When did you start to learn? You know how to do music? Like,
hey, man, it was really natural for me. It was like when I was little, I was really into drums immediately. Like, I really liked it, and I was in my dad's drummer Richie Albright would kind of give me lessons. And
you're on the road with them when you're a little kid?
Before school started, I would travel with them. All the time. And then, after, you know, like once school started, I would just go in the summers, essentially.
Yeah.
But I kind of fell in love with music very early. And then I don't remember why. I think my parents wanted me to take some kind of like extracurricular kind of class. And I took piano at 7 and
uh-huh.
I did 2 years of it. And I hated it because of the recital and the type of crap they'd make you learn. It was like not the stuff that I wanted to, but it was good for me. It was some kind of structure on how to mess with the piano and coming from like drums and messing around with drums. It's a percussive instrument. It was a lot of fun. So I instantly kind of started fooling around with making my own shit. And then, you know, I loved music. I would buy records when I first got a CD player. You know, Danzig 1 was one of the first records I bought. User Illusion 1 and 2. All these records that were like so big for me. And then, like, then it kind of took a turn where I think my biggest thing that kept me from starting a band was that I really wasn't very cool with many people in school, and I didn't have friends that were like guitar players or like other musicians.
Right.
I kind of was locked in my own little world. And when I heard the Nine Inch Nails, I was like, oh shit. I was like, and I was a computer nerd growing up. Like,
right.
I'm definitely not the archetype for a country outlaw country. Like, I don't hunt.
Yeah.
I you know, I program computer games.
Hey, you drink and smoke weed and play guitar and wear boots. You're all set.
There you go. There you go. That's right. I do those things. They all have their reasons.
Yeah.
No, but like once I heard that, I kind of was one guy can make all this. I was like, oh, I can do that. I can play piano. I can play drums. It kind of like it gave me a place to aim.
So Reznor was like, it you was, know, you were like, I can do this. And did you do that early on?
Yeah, very much so. Like I'm not saying it was, I was good at it like that, but that was where I started. And I would be like programming drums and music and making tracks and coming up with, you know, shitty lyrics and working. And the reason it evolved into what became Stargun was because through that, whether or not this is the cool way to discover Bowie, the way I discovered Bowie was through Nine Inch Nails.
Well, it's generational, you know, however you get there.
Yeah, and I became obsessed with him, and I got really into, like, I got really into glam rock, that era, like, and, you know, T-Rex and Slade and all that. And then I got into, like, the Beatles and Pink Floyd and psychedelics and all that. And so by the time that I was moving to L.A., I had like gotten so far into the glam rock thing and I was starting to get in, like it was just starting to morph into like this other more modern version of it, which is what is kind of cringy to me because where we were right before we hit that version of Stargun was very, very 70s, you know, and once we got here, it kind of became a mishmash of glam and like, I don't know, and some riff rock and whatever. It was kind of like just finding our way, you know. But
well, I think it seems to me like when I look at, you know, and listen to you most of the records that you've done is that, you know, you do find your way. You know, it seems like, you know, you have this an interesting pattern of like, you know, after Stargun, you'll do a country record pretty much, you know, with there are other elements where you're listening and you're like, well, that doesn't, okay. So, you know, but it's good.
Right.
But then all of a sudden you'll just be like way out there. but it seems like every other record or so you go back to country and then you're like, nah, I'm bored. I'm gonna do this other thing.
Right.
I'm not sure what it is, but it's going to, you know, make sure that everyone's going to go like, what the fuck happened?
Yeah, I know. Some guy, I did an interview for our Pappy and Harriet show that we have coming up, and this guy goes, so you've confused country fans and you've confused your fans many times, so what are you going to do next? You know, I'm like, well, thank you. But no, but I mean, at some point for me, it became, there was a, you know, there was a couple moments like where I'm sure it was like a what the fuck, but then after a while of me like what the fucking with Left Turns, I think people started to kind of expect the next what the fuck moment to happen.
Well, my question is, so you like, you know, cause you know, you can sort of hear Reznor through, you know, a lot of the records. I think like, you know, two or three or four of the records that you've done, like, you know, elements, like I can see where you sourced, you know, kind of, I'm just saying
it's still there. Oh yeah, for sure.
Well, I mean, on that one, that weird one, that sort of like, that summoning. Phoenixon.
What that actually is that was recorded before Stargun, before all. That was me programming shit at my house and my dad singing on it. Like the week
that's like from like before.
97. That's from 97.
So that's actually when he was alive.
Yeah.
Here I thought you were like going through shit trying to process because of when it came out. So that was actually during that time when, so your dad was sort of being supportive?
Very supportive. He was really into it. Like anything I would play him shit I was listening to and I played him the Downward Spiral and I was like, this record
I just
is
listened
shit.
To that 2 days ago.
Oh, it's such a good record.
Isn't it?
Oh man, it's still to this day one in my top probably five records of all time. Just how profoundly influential it was, but at the same time, just what an experience. And I wish he would still do that. He doesn't do that. Like he doesn't
He did the one after it was good.
Fragile is great.
Yeah.
But it was double length and all. That's my wife's favorite, but Downward Spiral was always mine because it was like all these found sounds and samples and
dark too. It's just dark, like, you know, just like
not a lot of drum machines. It felt more like the sample drums than he'd be using them and everything. I thought that was such a cool.
And the melodies were great and the songs were great. So you're sitting there with old Waylon.
Yeah. Playing. And then he does an interview and he says in the interview, because he was a little concerned lyrically with it, because I'm 15 and I'm like playing him like, you know, God like is dead and,
God is
you know, and all that. And he's like, but he's cool because he ain't gonna fuck with that. He knows what it's like to be a kid and be into what you're into. But then he goes and does an interview and he says that Trent Reznor is a musical genius, but a lyrical idiot. And I was like, what have you done? Like, I mean, this is my guy. And you just, Waylon Jennings just went out there and said this shit. You know, and I was like, oh, no.
You're ruined.
I know.
But he sat with you and did and worked on that record. Because this is an odd thing. Yeah. I didn't know anything that you're telling me. I just looked at the dates things were released. But that was really your first efforts.
Yes, ever.
And your dad was like there for you.
Yes. He's like, let's do a record together.
And that was the one you chose.
We made up a band together, and it was like I made all the music, and he played guitar and sang a lot, and I sang some of it.
And he just let you control it.
Yeah.
Clearly.
Yeah.
And so do you regret that you didn't have an opportunity to do a straight-up country record with your old man?
I mean, it would have been cool. It would have been cool, you know, but I don't regret it because it was such a, like, innocently, like, childlike collaboration. Like,
and
it
he
was,
did it. Like, he
was so into it.
And he just wanted, because he probably, it's out of his wheelhouse, but he was probably excited that you were excited about something.
Yes, about music. And we both, you know, he would play me records like Dire Straits, and I'd play him like fucking Tool and shit, you know.
He turned you on to Dire Straits? He liked that. He liked his guitar playing.
He always loved Dire Straits.
You covered a
Walk of Life, did. Yeah. My dad did several songs by them and over the years, and he used to love them. I remember when On Every Street came out, he was like playing that one a lot. And that was around the time I was like playing him like fucking White Zombie, Astral Creep 2000 or something.
Yeah.
Metallica or something, you know.
It's like, Johnny Cash did the great cover of Hurt.
Yeah.
That must have blown you away. How close were you with him at all?
Yeah, I was, man. He was actually my godfather. But I got to have several kind of profound, long conversations with him where it was just me and him.
Oh, yeah?
Which are pretty cool.
What do you lay on you?
Interesting stuff. I remember a conversation where I don't think he understood me quite at this point. I don't mean that critically. He was always very kind. But remember, we had this long conversation, and he was asking about computers. And I, at the time, was very into him, as I still am today.
Yeah.
And the very early burgeoning internet. And I was like, it was even before that. It was when I modem stuff I was doing. But he was like, you know, that's escapism. Like, sometimes you have to get out, you have to face reality. And I get the message that he was saying.
Yeah.
I was like, man, not really. This is where I live. And the rest of the world's going to live here, too, in 30 years, you know. But no, I mean, I got what he meant, though. He had, like, several
I think he's turning out to be right.
I think he's turning out to be. I think he saw Facebook somewhere in there.
Yeah, he had a vision.
He had a vision.
Soon everyone will think they're connected, but they'll really be isolated.
That's, yeah, that is
he knew.
It.
He knew.
Yeah, man. But like, you know, just conversations like that, and he always was kind of like a wealth of no musical conversations.
Yeah.
Really, it was always kind of like life lessons, philosophical.
Yeah, and so your dad stayed close to him too.
They would. They were really funny, man, because they would have moments where they didn't talk for periods of time because they were like very similar. They had, like. They both picked cotton. They both grew up listening to the Grand Ole Opry. They both had this very similar raising. And I think that's why when they met, they felt a certain kinship that was different than Willie's. Cause like Willie and my dad had very, very different backgrounds.
Yeah.
But, and Willie was like a jazz dude. And
yeah. And a big songwriter for others.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did your dad do much of that?
Not really. He didn't even really write a shitload of songs. Towards the end of his life, he did, but it would be like record to record. There'd be one or two, three songs maybe that he wrote.
Those early records is like, I could see how there was sort of like him and Johnny Cash would sort of understand each other.
For sure.
You know, it felt like, you know, these guys were, you know, sort of powerful.
They lived kind of together. So it was like they had a period of time in Nashville where they both had apartments that were like, they shared an apartment, and then my dad's band had an apartment.
Uh-huh.
I think some of Johnny's guys had an apartment all in this one complex.
Oh, wow.
And they would like hide their drug use from each other. So it'd be
it's
like.
It's funny because they're both pill guys.
Yeah.
It's good that they did because some of them would have been pissed off.
You know, we're working on a Waylon movie and there's a script that we have done. And, this guy has a great scene in it where they're like, they both go into the shitter and they both go in the bathroom and pop their pills and flush the toilet at the same time. Like not to let the other person know, but they're both doing the same thing. You know, it'd be kind of.
Oh, so they go way back. So they would have spats occasionally?
Yeah, they would occasionally have spats. It would usually be because, like, either one person, like, it would be over random stuff. Like, yeah. like Johnny would be like, he's sober, but then he got on some pain pills one time and my dad's mad because he's not really sober, but he's like, but I'm in pain. And like, they'd have this kind of not talk for 2 months or whatever. And then they, you know, then they make up and
so would, they're like a married couple.
Totally. Totally. Like the odd couple.
That's hilarious. So, okay. So you know, you make this, you do that thing with your dad, but when you come out here, you got your heroes in place. I just find it interesting that, you know, because of the music that you liked and because, you know, you're a musician, that you were sort of able at the beginning to do what you wanted to do and do it well. But then at some point, you know, after Stargun, I mean, you snap back and that first country records, or Put the O Back in Country, is a country record.
Right.
I mean, like, full on, right?
Yeah, right, right. It had some psychedelic hard rock moments in it, but definitely like got to a place where, like, the Stargun thing lasted too long. I love those guys and everything, but yeah. Like, I moved here with one band, which was very much the more 70s glam thing.
Right.
And like a couple members, we kind of like splintered, and another guy came in, and we were kind of scrambling to keep the band alive, and we kept alive for a couple more years, and we got like a little following in town and stuff, but we thought we were going to have a moment with a record label. Tom Morello produced like an EP that was going to come out, and it was like we had all this stuff kind of going on, but I could already tell, and I didn't have the experience yet to know that it was kind of an empty well that I was going to with this. It just wasn't the right thing for me to be excited about.
Yeah.
And so when we broke up the band, it was kind of like a lot of factors resulted in the breakup of the band. And then I kind of just went back. My dad had just died. I'd been listening to a lot of stuff that he's influenced by. I'd really took a huge dive into Hank Jr.'s catalog because uh-huh. I had liked certain records, but I hadn't really explored his catalog. And I just was like, there was so much of that I related to, but I didn't want to just go do a straight country record. Like, to me, musically, country music sucked. So
yeah.
Like, to me, it was like, why can't a country record sound cool?
And this like, has been the problem for people of your ilk for years.
Yeah, right. Of your ilk. Yeah, man. So it was like the original goal.
I'm country,
was
but I don't like this new country.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What I mean, even like not being able to like kind of pull in elements of like hard rock and modern rock and you know, I don't mean like fucking System of a Down, but you know, like.
No, you do
like,
that on all the records. There's definitely under there, there's always something, huh?
It just, why not, you know, and that's the music that I listen to, so to me it would be a disservice to like just deny. Like, it's weird, you run into a lot of guys, like I've read interviews with like Kenny Chesney, people I don't even really know their music, but they'll say like, man, when I was little all I did was listen to, you know, Bob Seger, and you're like, why doesn't your record sound like fucking Bob Seger then? Like, shouldn't you, the
well,
shit
they did,
you listen
but
to?
Didn't they integrate that eventually? I mean, didn't sort of like, it seemed like there was a period there where there was a shift and there was some like, you know, a little bit of hip hop coming in. There was a little bit, you know, when Garth Brooks sort of amped shit up a bit, you know, and he was taking certain chances, but.
For sure. I mean, every generation has had it. I mean, I guess my dad kind of, you know, brought the Buddy Holly side of stuff into it, and Hank Jr.
Wasn't
the
he a
Allman
Cricket?
Brothers. Yeah. Yeah,
I just remembered that
he was supposed to be on that plane, you know, which is just crazy. He actually,
how did I forget that? So he played guitar with Buddy,
bass,
right.
And he had just never even played bass. Buddy had let the Crickets go, really, is what happened.
Yeah,
like they were. He was gonna go. He had, I think, he'd intended to move to New York, and then he was going to London,
right,
to record. And so he put together a new band, and my dad was in that, and they did that Winter Dance Hall tour, and then, you know, they were gonna go, then go, and
so the plane was too full.
It was Buddy Holly's plane chartered for him and his band.
Yeah,
and it was like freezing outside. Then and they were gonna fly ahead just to do laundry because they didn't have anywhere to do it.
Yeah,
and the bus heating had broken down, so the Big Bopper asked my dad if he could have his seat on the plane, if my dad would ride the bus. My dad was like 19. He's like, fine, no problem. And then Richie Valens flipped a coin with Tommy Alsup for his position on the plane.
Oh, my God.
And got
God.
On the plane.
That's the story, huh?
That's the story. And so then as they were going, my dad, buddy says, I hope your old bus breaks down and you freeze to death. My dad goes, I hope your plane crashes.
No.
He did.
And he validates that story.
Yes. It haunted him for a very long time. Until a guy basically told him, can you bring him back? And he said no. And he goes, then you couldn't have killed him. You know what I mean?
But right. It's like, that's interesting. I've never heard that before. That's kind of powerful.
It's pretty wild. It really devastated him. At first, he gave up on music and he kind of lost all hope, and the way it all kind of came back around, and it took him a while just to get the feeling back, because this Buddy Holly was his protege. Like, he was taking him to New York for the first time and he's like showing him how to play bass and teaching him all about music, and my dad just like, holy shit, I found this dude who's like everything to me. And
yeah,
then it's like bam, gone, you know.
So young, right? There's probably only about 40 songs, right, that Buddy Holly's
on? Yeah, maybe that much.
It's so many great, like, I don't, you know, it's sort of incomprehensible.
It is.
And some of that Buddy Holly stuff.
Apparently he was such a maverick with that, like the way that his approach to everything was. I mean, he was a straight hillbilly, like, you know, as a guy, and here out of nowhere, my dad's sitting there working on a radio station, and kind of the way he met him, and he's just all of a sudden, he's this dude, he's got these glasses and he's got these moves, and it's like pop, but it's like rock. And like, one thing he told my dad, he's like, don't tell anybody your country or that you're rock, just tell them you're pop, because you got room to wiggle then. You can go either way with it, you know? And he had all these like kind of Buddy Holly-isms that tell my dad, and like, you know, always leave him wanting more. Don't play too long. Like, all this kind of stuff. But I mean, for someone to be that profound and different at that time, it's without crazy. Any kind of media to craft your thing after, I mean, it's like literally everyone was pretty isolated.
Yeah.
They had like the radio.
And there's a lot of variety to the songs too, man. My dad loved them. So like, you know, we got piped in that collection.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid in the 8-track in the car, just like all Buddy Holly music. And
so cool, man. It's such good. The guitar parts and stuff, even
crazy,
to this day,
man.
Like all the Sonny Curtis, you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, how's he doing
so,
that?
Yeah, it's so crazy for
even
that.
The simple rhythms are tricky.
Yeah.
I forgot. I knew that your dad was part. I'm glad we that came up. So you're frustrated with where country's at. You tap into Hank Jr. and you do that first record and you mix it up a little bit.
Yeah.
And how does that change your life?
It's, man, you know, I did, previous to it coming out, it really was. I mean, we were off the radar except for in this town, and it's like
in LA.
Yeah. So like,
and at that time it's you and who are the other bands?
It was, I'd put together a band.
Who was around with Stargun?
Oh, like, well, during that time, I mean, there were bands, like, I can barely even remember half of them, but I mean, like, we rehearsed in that, there was a rehearsal hall on Hollywood and Vine.
Yeah.
Where, like, it was every, like, Linkin Park had just broken out of that rehearsal hall, and like, Maroon 5 and these kind of bands like that.
Okay,
And so at the time, like, Audioslave, Tom had been a early on supporter of the band, and that was blowing up. A lot of big bands, but there was no scene of like
anymore.
Young bands,
it was already
really.
Done.
No, then there was a kind of country thing that was happening. They had the King. They had this thing called Westbound and Down. They would do, and there was like Icy Hawks in L.A. And there was like these down at the Molly Malone's. They had these Graham Parson nights. So there was like kind of a lot of that stuff happening in L.A.
It was, okay, yeah,
which was kind of cool. And I had just gone through at the same time like a. Graham phase. I was like you know, I had not done that discovery yet, so I'd gone through all his records.
When you were out here before Hank Jr.
Before the Hank Jr. period. Yeah, I'd gone through that.
And what would you just say about like Graham, like, you know, having the head you have and coming for where you come from, what made him so unique?
Man, he was so unique because he was literally a rich kid from Florida who was like, I want to do country, and came to LA for whatever reason and connected with the Birds and all that. Like, his story is so unique because it bypassed Nashville altogether. It had so many elements, that later in, you know, the Dead and like, of course, like Chris Hillman and the Birds and the Stones, like
the
all
Eagles.
The tie-ins of country into rock and roll.
Yeah.
The Eagles. Yeah. Like, well, there was a dude before Graham named Steve Young that came here, and he was kind of the first. He came from Alabama. He wrote like Seven Bridges Road that the Eagles did. He wrote Lonesome on Your Mean that my dad did. He did Montgomery in the Rain that Hank Jr. did. These great songs. He came here first before Graham, and he kind of was the first dude who started like seeding Los Angeles and Hollywood with a lot of this, because he's from Montgomery, so it was a lot of this Hank Williams scenes and things, and he was kind of rolling around.
I think
with,
I have his record.
He's great.
It's a great record.
He's great. He has got tons of great records that are out there, and I got to be friends with him before he died, and he sent me his entire catalog. Sometime I have like a hard drive, and if you're into him, I'll give you the whole thing.
Dump it on there.
It's pretty cool. But
So
Graham was kind of like the next guy.
Right.
So it was like, but Steve kind of sowed some seeds that kind of led to like a lot of the Glenn Campbell and the Wrecking Crew shit that was happening with like Tanya Tucker and all that. Like it all kind of of course Merle and Buck and all that kind of coming down. But Graham was like really unique because he was a rock dude who was obsessed with country, and he was at the end of the day, in a weird way, he probably would be flipping in his grave, but he was still kind of like this rock and roll dude to the end.
Right.
Who just sang country all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and that was like such a,
but the music, you know, like you listen to the music, like this is what I never can understand, because even your new record Shooter with Dave Cobb is that
yep.
You know, again, because he does some Sturgill stuff, like he's a guy,
and he did the first five of mine too,
but he's clearly evolved as a producer into like there's some sort of reverence for that classic country production, right?
Yes,
that goes way back to like '60s and '70s, right?
Yes, for sure. That's the best era,
right.
Of that and rock in a lot of ways.
Sure. But the thing that always strikes me is that when you listen to these guys that were sort of pivotal in the new country back then, like Graham and the Byrds and stuff, it's like, it just sounds like country to me. So I can't, like, the nuance, the songwriting I get, but it's not like they're swinging. They're not like making the beat any different. They still swing a lot of them. And it's not sort of like, wow, this is really different. That's why I never understood the struggle between what, maybe it's because I don't live in it, this idea that this is mainstream country and this is Graham Parsons. Like, why the fuck couldn't Graham Parsons play with Buck Owens? It could have happened.
That absolutely could have happened. I don't know about their struggle then.
Yeah.
Because like, it was quite a bit different, but I think that, I mean, nowadays the struggle between mainstream and all that is like, it's a weird, it's almost two different things. I don't even like pay attention to really mainstream country. I don't really know anyone who does, and I couldn't really name anything that's on the radio. I could kind of identify some of these guys, but dude, it is a operation, and these people walk in with nothing except for a voice, and they are, from the minute they enter that place to the minute they get out there.
Oh, it's a machine.
It is a machine, and it's like Graham Parsons, who knows about Buck Owens, because we're talking about California. California is pretty unique, but that same machine has been in place in Nashville from
day
one.
And it's been perfected because like the sort of importance of the songwriter in Nashville.
Right.
Like that, like there was everyone would gravitate. Like, that's not like that in New York and not really in LA, I don't think, but literally Nashville is like, this is where songwriters come to try to deliver the goods to the voices.
You had like Shel Silverstein and people like that back then.
Right. But like, there's just like, but the, it seems like the model was always like, we got a front man, let's fill his mouth with something. So they must so
it's true.
So they must just have perfected the machine. They must have just like
have.
Stacks of songs.
It's crazy how those sessions work. I've never done it myself, but I have lots of friends that do it, and they literally have like 10 10 right. Do you know Neil Casale?
No.
He plays guitar. He played in the Ryan Adams and the Cardinals, but now he plays with Chris Robinson, brother. Anyway, great player, but he always says, I got a co on that. Like somebody will say, like, I got a co on that, like for the co write, and they'll have these sessions in which they'll all day just write like whatever, like let's write a song about a hammer and a dice, and they'll write that
and then there's just the system. There's like basically there must be a template that's about five or six songs. A couple of slow country,
right?
And then there's about three or four different grooves of the fast country.
Right. And they always mimic what's a hit, because that's what's a hit now.
That's right.
So it's like a slow evolution.
So it all sounds the same-ish.
Right. And guys like Graham were not thinking of that at the time. And, and the greats of all this are not thinking about
it. No, of course not.
In any genre, though, I mean, you look at 80s hair metal and you look at, like, what became the processing plant of Sunset Boulevard, where it would just be like band after band after band after band that sounded like just like Van Halen or just like Def Leppard.
Sure.
Until you get like a GNR who's like irreverent about it. You know what I mean?
I guess the big switch was that you really, that became your center.
Right.
Right.
To some degree.
Right.
So it's not, that's a good way of putting it. The thing about that was that we had this success from this one song, 4th of July, on that record.
Yeah.
And I thought, we had already recorded our second record, and our second record was pushing the boundaries. It was more rock. It was
well, no, I hear that. So that's so weird that you like, because I'm looking at these releases and I'm listening to them in sequence, because Electric Rodeo definitely had more elements of rock in it.
Yes.
And I was like, how did he go? Like,
I thought it was an evolution. To me, it was like the first one had some elements of that, but it was very
so it was supposed to be Electric
segregated.
Radio first.
No, no, put the O was first, but it was like the rock. And the country elements were a bit separated on that record.
Yeah.
And I thought with Electric Rodeo, I said, here, we're going to blend it all into one sound.
Yeah.
But we were immediately rejected for that record. And that began my lesson about
because you all of a sudden just birthed all these new country fans.
Right. And then all of a sudden, yeah. And it was still, in my opinion, it came out as a country record. It was always a country record. It's still country no matter
Electric Rodeo.
What, to some degree. Yeah. But it was just like, we wanted to push the boundary a little further on the sound and like see, cause you know, it was just, why does it have to all be like Lynyrd Skynyrd knockoffs? Why can't you be like pulling from Zappa in a country record, or whatever?
You can't answer that question?
Yeah.
Because there's the guys who are used to the six songs going, what's he doing in my head?
No, I know.
What's he doing in my head?
We're trying to expand your head, man. We're trying to get you to wake up and have some fucking taste. You know, it's like, but no. But
do they comment? Did people come up to you and go, no, what are you doing?
Not that one. I'll tell you the one that where they got me was the Black Ribbons.
That was the concept record?
Yeah, it was
Stephen King record?
Yeah, yeah. Like that was when I started
realizing. That was where they had it. That was where they're like, look, we liked a couple songs on those shitty records.
Yeah,
but like, what the fuck is this?
That's exactly what happened. And then like YouTube, I remember YouTube comment that said, you are officially banned from Texas. And
like, Texas, thank you.
Thank you. Wow. You know, and it, I mean.
We should say, like, I always get in cause trouble. I love Texas. There's some good parts of Texas.
Oh, I love Texas.
Yeah, yeah. So that was it. But Black Ribbon was it.
Yeah, that was the actual quote on YouTube. But yeah, I mean, that was the one where it first had that reaction, but now, like, in retrospect, that record is the one that's probably given me the most back, and it has been the one that has, in my opinion, lasted the longest with the fans. Like, people really woke up to the record, but it took them a minute because they weren't ready for it. But it was like,
it's a story.
That was the exciting part about it, man.
Right?
It's exciting to go do something and say, this is going to be weird. And it's one thing to, like, have a crazy idea, but not be able to carry it out. And I felt like me and Dave Cobb were able to carry that record out. And it was like, when we did that, I was like, okay, now here's something I'm fucking proud of. We really fucking did something weird here.
Yeah.
You know, and I knew that the reaction would be crazy. But at the same time, like, I knew that it's a long game. I'm not in it for a short game thing. So.
Well, and also, you know, as a creative person, as an artist, if you don't take chances, then, you know, you're just going to be a shell of yourself. You know, you just end up, you know, wandering around, getting on stage and going through the motions.
Yeah. And that's, I don't want to do that. I would rather quit before I do that.
But the concept record, it's interesting because there, you know, obviously there's been concept records before and, you know, and Willie did that one.
Spirit.
Or Redheaded Stranger.
Oh, that
really.
One too.
Yeah, I mean, which is sort of a story.
Of course,
and it's
fantastic.
It is, you know, but I don't know that was the most successful record for him outside of the hit.
I don't think outside from Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain.
Yeah.
But it's often regarded as the best country album of all time.
Is it?
Yeah, it's often the number one on the list of all
the
best country records.
Of the Preacher.
So, yeah, I love that.
It's
I
great.
Love that, man. And then, you know, Phases and Stages. A bunch of his records were concept records. So
yeah.
It was like,
So what led to the partnership with Stephen King? I mean,
Well, I dreamed up this record and I had this DJ part in it. And at first I was going to reach out to Art Bell, and I did reach out to Art Bell about it. And then I second guessed the decision because I thought, man, people are going to think this is Art Bell. I loved Art Bell growing up.
Sure.
And I wanted somebody who was a little different. You know, people didn't know, and his voice, and there was a oh, that's funny. I have that book, that Apocalypse Culture too. But anyway,
it's a great book. The first one's better.
I haven't heard. I don't.
Well,
have
I mean, it's
one.
A lot of the same stuff, but they added some stuff, but they also took out a couple.
Ooh.
The second one.
gonna have to go to that.
It's hard to find that first one.
Oh man. Anyway, so where that happened was. I mean, I've been a Stephen King fan since I was really young.
Yeah.
And I was reading, he wrote about me in his EW column he used to do in the back of EW about his favorite, like, country songs or something. And 4th of July was on there.
Oh, that's nice.
And then he wrote my
name.
It's
a good feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, when you yeah. love, you have reverence for somebody, and all of a sudden you realize, like, hey, they know my shit.
Crazy. It's crazy when that happens, especially when they turn out to be such amazing people. Manson was like that when we became friends. But so
I talked to him. He was a little loopy.
I heard him. He had his little Fiji bottle.
Yeah,
love it. So Stephen King, then he wrote my name in a book.
Yeah.
It was in Lycee's story. Just really quickly, and he. It was my name was right next to fucking Big and Rich too. I was like, Jesus Christ. But anyway, so I was like, okay, the dude, I'm on his radar. So I like wrote, I was gonna do an interview for some record I was doing with EW. And I said, I'll do it, but will you pass this letter to Stephen King? Cause I tried to reach him and I couldn't find any way to reach him.
Yeah.
So I wrote an email, and that afternoon he got back to me. And
oh, yeah.
He was like, he's like, I'm too busy to do this, but if you hound me, maybe it'll get done. And so I just sent him the ideas that went along. And then like one day we had a lot of emails back and forth. I never met him. I've never talked to him on the phone. And one day it just showed up in my house done. And I was like, holy shit.
Yeah.
He did it. You know what I mean?
He did it. That's great.
So we put it in there and we've kind of remained friends, like, but only via email and stuff. Uh-huh. But now I'm working on a new project that he's involved in, so maybe I'll get to meet him.
That's wild. And the album is, I imagine some of the fans are sort of like, it is a sort of a political record. I mean,
it is, in a way. I was not aiming to make a political record. To me, it was more of like a, you know, I had become really into, like, a lot of these, like, writers and conspiracy writers and these kind of theories. I had heard that David Icke dude on, like,
on
Coast to Coast AM with his reptiles thing.
Sure. Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this guy's out there.
Yeah.
And I was like, but just conceptually, just this world of insanity.
Yeah.
I started looking up all, you know, Manly P. Hall and the Mason people and all these other fucking people and reading about
it. Go ahead and say it, the Jews.
Jesus Christ.
Guy, I know what you're saying.
No. But like, I just kind of was like reading all this shit and the conspiracy world was just fascinating to
me. Sure. I was there too. I've been there. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
And so like, when I was doing the record.
Unfortunately, now it's a dominant cultural dialogue for people who want to erase the truth. But when early on, it was sort of interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was very interesting. It also seems like during that time, it's 2008, so it was like the end of the George Bush thing was when we were doing the record, and when Obama happened, like for me, I've never taken a political stance, and I never will because I think there's so many.
It's a little rough, man. Like it was weird. I had this weird thing where I was listening to NPR and they were interviewing Loretta Lynn, you know, who was just sort of like, Trump's going to save us, and I'm like, oh, why you got to talk? Why don't you don't have to talk about it? I want to love you. You know,
right. I mean, but when that Bush thing was happening, like everybody. It was insanity, and then that like the housing crisis happened, and then like Obama's like won, and it's like all gonna happen, and it was all so weird. Everything was so fucking weird and negative, and there was all this like
from where you were living.
Yeah, well, no, from here in LA. I mean, what am I supposed to say? Like I was like overcome with hope. Like no, I was like there was nothing. Everything seemed insane. Like when the housing crisis hit, especially.
No,
like,
absolutely
like,
right. Yeah,
everybody was where's Bush?
Yeah,
where'd he go? You know,
on the way out, those guys just sort of like, and we're taking all the money.
Yeah. That's exactly what happened. And so like it was like I didn't know where we were, and so it was like I just kind of made up this concept of this fictional band that was like, you know, they were going to shut off the airwaves and there wasn't going to be a voice anymore. And it was like this fictional band was kind of the fuck you band for this guy to play on his last night in, you know.
The DJ that you created.
Yeah.
I think it's ballsy, man, because like the way you talk about it, it was a genuine reaction to the confusion and fear and anger or whatever you were feeling.
There's so much fear mongering going on.
And you're trying to reach, right. And also trying to reach some sort of, you know, trying to process it. So you processed it with this weird concept record.
Right.
Which Dave Cobb produced as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting your history with him because like your Family Man's a country record. Yeah. You deal with themes.
Yeah.
I mean, you have a family. You've been through a heartbreak. You've been through kind of a divorce. You've got a couple of kids. I mean, like, you know, that's the other thing about looking at country where it's sort of like, I know these stories.
Yeah. That's right.
Do these guys live these stories? Are they just like, you know, what are we going to write about today? You know, like, ah, I'm sad. But there was a, that it seemed like some of the stuff on that record was you trying to reckon with the fact that you're this guy that has this responsibility and you try to do the best you can, but you're not necessarily making the grade.
That's right. And then the other life is kind of when it all goes, you know,
it goes bad.
Goes bad. And then, you know, figuring out, I mean, it's very much traceable journey of reality. But do you
get along with her, the ex?
Yeah, I have to.
You got
kids.
Two kids.
Yeah, we do great. I mean, like,
what's her name again?
Drea DiMatteo.
Yeah, the actress. She's great.
Yeah, she, but like, you know, we, they
oh,
go
parent?
To kid, they go, yeah, they yeah. go to school with parents who fucking hate each other that are either married or not married anymore.
Oh, it's the worst.
So it's like, we're able to definitely get through it. And her dude is one of my favorite, Drea's dude, Michael Devin, who's in, Whitesnake.
Oh, yeah.
I've used him on some records that I produced and stuff. I love that guy. And then, like, you know, Misty, my wife, we all get along really well.
Oh, that's great.
So it's like,
what a fucking
blessing.
It's a
very lucky situation for the kids. You know, they get to see, like, people that are actually happy.
And then you can do it. Like, you know, it's really a matter of acceptance and getting over whoever feels fucked off, you know, moving through that.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, moving, that's a good way of putting it. It's not even moving beyond it or around. It's like
right.
through it.
You yeah. I mean,
it.
You know, and like, cause no matter what, as you get older, you realize that, you know, everything that you thought was, you know, just, you know, it was never going to be different.
Right. Right.
It doesn't fucking matter anymore in some ways. You're like, oh, God.
Yeah, oh, dude, totally. I mean, because when you're, you know, you're 20-something years old,
yeah.
it's like everything has such profound meaning and impact, and
yeah.
everything is so big, and how do I feel today? You
yeah.
know, and it's like, and I'm fucking 40 now, and I'm like, God damn, leave me alone. You know, I'm just like, want everyone to leave me alone.
Yeah. I'm just trying to.
I the price is right, man.
Yeah, right. I don't give a fuck. I finally reached the freedom. Him to not give a fuck about a lot of stuff, and I just want to sit here and do this.
Yeah, that's right, man. That's right.
So, but that record was a very odd record. How do you say? How come I can't pronounce
Countach?
Yeah, I would never have
said
that right.
It's like a Lamborghini Countach.
Okay, fine.
Because Giorgio is Italian.
Giorgio like, Moroder.
Yep.
And he was like, I learned this stuff, you know, yesterday.
Oh, no, dude, Giorgio Moroder, you know who he is.
No, I know his songs. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But what I'm trying to figure out is like, what is Shooter Jennings sitting there thinking? Like, you know. It's time for me to do an homage.
Okay. The George record. All right. I'll tell you how this kind of started. Years before, a guy had asked me to write some songs for George Jones' final record.
Yeah.
But so I wrote these two songs, sent them to the dude. He's like, it's great. Let's see what the possum says. Well, that dude turned out to be completely full of shit. He wasn't doing a record on George Jones, and I had just written two songs and sent them to this dude. So I was like,
was those the ones that ended up on the tribute?
Yeah. So I said, I'm going to put those two songs out. And at the time, I'd gone down this like rabbit hole of Giorgio Moroder, and it kind of started with that Daft Punk record,
yeah.
Random Access Memories. But I just didn't realize how much of the music that I grew up in that this one guy was responsible for.
Right.
I just kind of assumed it was the sound of the 80s.
Yeah.
It was a thing. So when I kind of went down that rabbit hole and started listening to all these solo records of his, I just became kind of obsessed with it. And this company was really into the idea. I was going to put out those two George Jones songs and maybe do a couple others. They were really into the idea of me doing it. I was very defiant about just doing a George Jones thing. So my idea was I'm going to do George and Giorgio. And it was going to be these kind of two pieces.
Yeah.
And which is what I ended up doing. And I was like, but I like for the George one, I used a lot of the equipment that Giorgio used on his records. And for the Giorgio one, I used like live fiddle and instruments that George used and kind of mixed the whole thing up. And
but like, tell people like who like Giorgio is. Like,
okay.
What were the songs?
Everyone knows that he defined, you know, disco by
right.
producing all that stuff, but he was really like the first person to sync Moog synthesizers with a click and get them all talking. And of course he did like the Neverending Story, and he did like
right.
the Top Gun theme song, and like
Highway
to the Danger Zone,
yeah, sure,
lots of movies
yeah.
and TV shows. And I was really infatuated with the lyrics and the musical, especially the musical arrangements. And then like Hunter S. Thompson always said that when he was younger, he would retype Ernest Hemingway novels.
Yeah.
And doing this Giorgio record was kind of like that, because I became like intimately aware of these really weird arrangements, like
yeah.
like The Neverending Story. Like that song just a kid's theme song from a movie that I saw when I was a kid or whatever, but it's really weird and intricate, and the chord changes and the rhythms. And
yeah.
But I found some early shit of his where it was not electronic at all. It was kind of country and weird. Like, that song isn't very far from what his arrangement was, which was really strange. So it was like he had a really peculiar kind of like journey musically that it just, the more I looked, the more and more I loved it, and more I wanted to do, you know, carry this record out. And to me, like, it was one of those kind of records where, like, a lot of people are like, what the fuck? But a lot of people, like, ended up really loving it. Like, it, in the press, it was received really well. So it's like, you know, it kind of opened a lot of doors. Like, that record and Black Ribbons have opened more doors for me to cool collaborations and cool friendships, as well as, like, people coming out of the woodwork that would never have taken note of my music or be like, say, like, a good example is like Kurt Sutter from Sons of Anarchy became like a really cool collaborator for me because he liked Black Ribbons and he started putting songs from it in the show.
Oh,
and
then, that's
like,
great.
That's how I met Manson, because he heard those and liked them.
Wow.
You know, and so all these kind of weird little avenues would happen, and Countach has kind of brought a lot of people that way. And so it seems like the more outlandish and kind of daring things that I do, the more they kind of create these trees of like new stuff for me to get into.
And also, like, you know, different types of creative people.
That's right. That's right.
Then this new record, which you just call Shooter.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a great country record, but I mean, it's like the most country record you've done.
That's right. It's the only one where I feel like I didn't have some axe to grind with, like, I'm, you know, musically, like, trying to prove I still had this other elements. I really went in and was like...
And, like, let me ask you about Dave Cobb, because, like, you know, he did Wheeler Walker. He does Sturgill, who I've talked to. Who's that other guy? Who's that guy that Sturgill played with on
Chris
SNL?
Stapleton.
Chris Stapleton? Mm-hmm. He's great, right?
Great. Great
but
guy,
so, like,
too.
Cobb, it seems to me that at one time, you know, the collaboration, you know, he could sort of do what you wanted him to do. Like, you know, he understood what you wanted, then he'd do it. But now it seems that Cobb has a very defined sound for himself.
He does. He does. But I don't feel like that with... Like, he and I still had the exact same relationship that we did before.
You just happened to want to do it.
Our phone conversation was, let's cut a Hank Jr. record. Like, we were like, let's go full country the whole way and not even, you know, even though there's stuff on there that kind of gets out there from country, but it's like our intention was to cut it just a through and through enjoyable, not heavy. But,
yeah, I loved it.
You know, country record. Thank you, man. Well, we set out to do that, and we had just done the Brandy record, which was pretty eclectic and had a lot of different angles, and we were both working really heavily on the arrangements and everything. So
which one's that?
It's called By the Way I Forgive You. She just put out this year.
And you were working, you produced it?
Me and Dave co-produced
it. Oh, that's great.
So that was kind of, that's what kind of got us working together again. And that was her bringing us in together. She wrote me, she goes, I want you to work on my new record. And then like 2 days later, she goes like, do you know Dave Cobb? And I was like, yeah, I know Dave. We've done a couple of records, man. You know,
how old is he, your age?
He's about 3 years older than me.
So now, like, what is the nature of your fan base? I mean, are they, do you get people that liked your dad? Do you get real country people?
Totally. I mean, it's across the board, and it has changed over the years because, you know, there was a big gap between my dad and myself, like, as far as the fans went. Like, there'd either be fans that were like young people who like my music, or there'd be like older people who like my dad's music. But now that all has kind of like mixed, and it's kind of a mixed bag, you know. Uh-huh. But like, I've been on the road with my band for about 2 years. Before that, I did 3 years with my dad's old band. Like, there was a period of time in which I'd done The Family Man, The Other Life. That was a New York City band that I'd put together. And it was getting to where, like, it was too expensive to tour. I wasn't making enough in the guarantees to afford, like, a bus. And it was kind of a struggle at this one point. It was probably, mid-2012 or something. And The Other Life hadn't even come out yet, and I was already financially in this position. It was a little shaky. And my old manager, the guy who came in, John Hensley, I was telling you about, he had this idea. I played this one show with the Waymore's Outlaws, which is really my dad's old band.
Yeah.
And I played this one show, and he's like, dude, you should take this on the road, because they have a vehicle they travel in. Me, you, and a merch person, which is his girlfriend at the time, we'll just drive everywhere they go. You don't have to sever contracts. You get paid your bit. your only expense is two hotel rooms and a car. And we did that for like 3 years and it saved me and it like got everything back up. It got my guarantees back up because the shows were doing well with them and I was able to get back in a place to get on my feet, you know. And, but at the same time, to answer your question,
you were kind of
I was servicing. I mean, even they were playing mostly.
You were broke
stuff.
Or what?
I wasn't broke. I mean, I didn't have to like move out of my house.
Right.
But I mean, it was around the time that I went through like the split ups and like getting on my feet. And at the same time, it was just that I had gone through a couple bad decisions with managers and with booking agents and it had gotten to where I was making this such a low amount per show.
Right.
That it was like a vacuum, you know,
right.
like the show would be low, the turnout would be low, then it would get lower. And then I'm trying to maintain a full band and a bus and all this. So it kind of gave me a point to start in which there was a story behind the package. It was different because it was my dad's old band and they would come out and do a whole set of like Waylon shit. And then I would come out and they'd do my stuff and I'd do some Waylon songs, but it would allow me to kind of duck out of big cities, do casinos, do like gigs like in small towns and sell out and do things. And it built my guarantee up. It built their guarantee up. It made it where we made money and we were able to kind of save and get keep the label going. And I was able to do it again where we could go on the road and get a bus and build that up. And now we're like, now the engine is rolling great and we're out on the road nonstop and we got the new record and everything. So it kind of was like, my point there was that there was a point in time, I think when I was younger, when I was like resentful of the Waylon factor, even though I was happy about it, I was happy that people would come, but it was very hard to differentiate. Like it, just some guy off the street who makes a career and has songs, he knows that the people who are showing up at his show are there because they like his music.
Sure.
There's no other reason.
Right.
But for me, there was like the Waylon reason. So it's hard to know. It's hard to trust your fans. Like, why are you here?
After a certain point, did you just accept it and embrace it?
I think that doing the tour at the Waymores, I mean, to some degree, yes. And I also ran off a bunch of them with Black Ribbon. So that was kind of a good thing in a way.
Yeah.
The wrong folks, and I shouldn't say the wrong, but you know what I'm saying? The people who were just looking for me to be Waylon Jr. Definitely were like, okay, I'm going to step out of here for a while.
They're coming back with this record.
They're coming back. They came back even afterwards, you know, but then doing the Waymores tour, it was really in a way like saying like, look, I'm, you know, even though they're playing my shit, I'm like, I was giving back to that crew too. And I think that people felt it kind of like healed some things with that. And it became an integration of the people instead of there just being the Waylon people and the Shooter people, like they were now like the same group. And
right.
It's like, so now they're all willing to kind of follow me and they know I'm not just like throwing my middle finger up in my dad's like legacy in their opinion.
Right.
That kind of stuff. So it kind of solved a lot of things in a weird way. And it was great to be on the road with my dad's old drummer, Richie, who was the fucking shit, and all those guys. It was so cool to have a band with them for 3 years.
I bet.
Kind of being that was a very weird thing. You know?
Well, it's funny because your dad was so supportive and you know, he was who he was, but he was also, you guys had a great relationship, but the only way you really could rebel because he was a decent guy was to, you know, to do it musically.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, you know, in order for you to sort of define yourself, you had to, you know, not say fuck you, dad, but say like, well, I'm going to do this other thing.
Yeah, which is what LA did. I was completely oblivious to it. By the time that first record came out, I had not even been thinking about really, but I mean, he died and I'm thinking about him that way, but I mean, it's like what didn't feel like I was being defiant. I felt like I was just, I think I might have found my way. I've been here in LA long enough and I think I might have figured out my sound, you know, and it like, so that's what it kind of felt like. But then once it came out, I think we kind of were touching on this before, but once that came out, that's when people started being like, you're not as good as your dad.
Yeah.
He'd be rolling over his grave. Yeah. And you're just like, okay.
Yeah.
Fuck you people.
Yeah.
Fuck all of you. Find me in LA. I dare you.
Yeah. But this one is like, it's a nice testament to like, I think who you are in terms of accepting, you know, that this, it's clearly something you love. I mean, the country music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And, absolutely. You know, and it's also just, you know, it's sort of, you know, it feels like you've worked through a lot of shit.
Yeah, that's true.
I feel that there will be another weird record in your future.
Yeah, definitely. I got to keep making left turns until I go in a circle, you know?
Now, what do you think about your father's influence in general? Like, cause I know there was like very, very specifically people said Sturgill sounded like your old man.
Yeah. I used to say that before, cause I introduced him and Dave Cobb and I like,
You introduced Sturgill Simpson to Dave?
Yeah, Sturgill, a guy named Blake Judd introduced me to Sturgill's music. He had a band called Sunday Valley before. Yeah. And it was like a kind of hard rock band in a lot of ways, but it kind of like Stargun was. I understand, like, he doesn't allow that shit online, even though I think that Sunday Valley had some great stuff.
He's like, and now he's doing some shit like you in the sense that, like, he'll rip out that guitar and you're like, that's not country.
Yeah, totally. He wins the country Grammy for his least country record. Uh-huh. Which is why I love why he's mixing it up. But like, when I first heard him, there were moments where I was like, man, it really sounds like early, like when my dad, it's almost like in the 70s, this is a really weird way of putting it, but this is the best way I can describe it, was in the 70s when my dad would do harmonies on his own vocals. He'd sing a little higher.
Yeah.
Sturgill sounded just like that to me. And it was like, there was a thing where I was like, wow, you know, that's really cool. And a really cool voice, you know, and it was awesome to watch him kind of go through these different phases as well. And he does the same kind of thing. Like, and like when he went left and he did the experimental record, I was like, I'm going real country then. He did that. I'm going all the way over here. You know what I mean? Let's see what happens next.
Yeah. Yeah. But you guys get
your
along.
Move. Yeah. I love Sturgill. We hang out a lot. Last time he came through town for like a day. We went to El Compadre and hung out, and he's a great dude.
Good man.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great record. It was certainly, I'm glad we finally got to meet and talk. It was great to hang out, man.
Yeah, man. Thank you for having me. I love the podcast, so it's cool to be in here and finally be on it. And then I got to thank Jeff Tate, especially because he was originally like trying to hook us up.
I know. I'm sorry I dropped the ball on that, because I went through my emails, man. And I'm like, oh, that was like 2 years ago.
Dude, it's okay. It's all right, man.
Oh, we did it, man.
Well, yeah, we're here. I had something to promote this time.
Oh, yeah. It worked out.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Of course, man. Thank you.
All right. That was Shooter Jennings. Rob Riggle before him. Fun times, fun talks. I hope you know, nothing happened in between me recording this and you hearing it that needed to be addressed, or that left it impossible for anyone to hear this. I'm okay. You okay? I'm all right. I'm gonna have some pistachios. Boomer lives.